Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're really glad you're able to make it today, and we're excited for our topic and speakers. I'm Charles Eichenbaum with the Windows Azure Marketing Team, and I'm here with two great guest speakers, Forrester Research VP and Principal Analyst James Staton, and Senior TEI Consultant Sean Owens. Today, they'll cover some of the key economic considerations when migrating to the cloud. We'll leave 10 to 15 minutes at the end for Q&A after the presentation. You can start submitting any questions you have right now, and we'll answer as many as we can at the end. And with that, I'll hand it over to James.
Great. Thanks so much, and thanks, everyone, for joining us here today. We're going to be talking a lot about a key topic in cloud computing, the topic of cloud economics, because one of the things that's really different about cloud platforms and the use of cloud resources is the economic model associated with them. So it's really important to understand what that economic model is, which is a lot of what I'm going to be covering or during today's agenda. Then I'm going to head over to Sean to talk about some customers who have actually achieved those economics by using the cloud platform that we analyze using a Forrester TEI study, and Sean will go into the details of that. Then we'll talk about how you actually turn the cloud economics on to your advantage, and we'll talk about a customer who actually has already done that as a good example of what you should be thinking about in your own planning going forward. So to get started, let's talk about exactly what we mean by cloud economics. What we mean by cloud economics primarily is that there's two basic rules. In the cloud, when you scale out, you turn on the cloud, meaning that you turn on the economic model because you're paying for the resources by the drink. So the more you drink, the more you're turning on the economic model. How you turn the economic model to your favor is by understanding that turning up can also have the corollary of turning down, and turning down turns off the bill for the resources that were already in use. And understanding how to take advantage of these two aspects is core to understanding cloud economics. Now, there's basically three rules around cloud economics that makes cloud platforms different than traditional hosting, hosting things in your own data center, deploying to other types of implementations or outsourcing options. First is the concept of automatic standardized elastic scale that allows you to have just-in-time capacity for applications. That means your application must be able to scale elastically in a horizontal fashion. So we're not talking about turning off a small instance and turning on a large. We're talking about starting with a small and adding a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth small, and adding other resources such as storage and caching and other capabilities in the same fashion. One of the reasons that cloud platforms can pull this off is because their cost model is extremely granular. It allows you to pay for the resources only when you need them at a very small increment. This increment can be an hour, it can be a fraction of an hour, it can even go down to a minute. It really depends on the model that you use and the cloud platform that you leverage to do that. The third rule is self-service. Self-service means that your developers, the people who are building your application, who just in time may make changes to that application, have autonomous access to the resources necessary to make those changes. So there's no filling out a request form for the IT department, waiting for them to evaluate that, checking out the resource capabilities, seeing if we have capacity, buying additional capacity if we don't, what could be a 6 or 8 week process. In the cloud, everything is standardized, everything is automated, everything is shared, and therefore everything is available for immediate deploy. You want your developers to be able to immediately access these resources and turn them on, and that's where you get some of the great productivity and efficiency that is driving the agile development model that we see so prominent in the cloud today. So to go into a little more depth on each of these things, when we talk about the elastic scale, to really turn cloud economics on, you want to be able to use elastic scale to your advantage, which means understanding when you can turn resources off, not just on, but off, and being able to understand in detail how your application performs so that you know that off is not going to diminish the performance of the application, but is appropriate to the pattern of use that you've already observed. Second thing you want to look at is how small can you get your base footprint, because the smallest your base footprint is the minimum amount of consumption or minimum cost your platform or application is going to have during its ongoing use. and then try to leverage caching services and caching functions as much as possible because they don't consume a full resource. They're a much lower cost resource, geographically dispersed in some cases, and can offload the need for greater physical resources or virtualized physical resources that you'd primarily need to support the application. What you scale? The key thing here is understanding how your application actually performs. This is where tools like New Relic and AppDynamics become very valuable. They help you inspect your application to see what parts of your application actually do scale and what types of circumstances. The more you can break this down, where the application is not one big executable, but is a set of small components, you can actually scale just the components. And that's where you can get even greater efficiencies in the use of cloud, where you can find cloud services that are native in the cloud that can supplement what you might have written yourself as well and allow you to get greater efficiency from the use of the cloud. And then the last piece is to really understand when and where you deploy things. Some application capabilities you may not have to have deployed at the start or all the time. There may be certain functions and capabilities that can simply stay parked most of the time until they're actually activated. And we'll show you that at the end of our presentation today, one company that does exactly this. And it's a great way to get greater efficiency out of the cloud. The other thing to think about is not only when, but where. And where can mean where geographically you deploy certain things. It can be where in the cloud service, and it can be how you leverage the cloud. Is it where, meaning it requires its own compute resource? Or is it where, in that it's leveraging SQL Server, for example, that's already managed and maintained in a multi-tenant fashion by Microsoft for you, as one example. So there's multiple ways you can leverage these cloud platforms that will really help you optimize how the application goes forward. So let's talk now about companies who have understood this and have moved forward in leveraging Azure in order to achieve those objectives. Sean?
Thanks, James. I'm Sean Owens. I'm a senior consultant with Forrester, with the TEI, Total Economic Impact Consulting Group. Throughout last year, we conducted a total economic impact study with a number of Azure customers. And if you're not familiar with it, I'll just quickly go through the TEI process so we understand the solution. We conduct customer interviews. In this case, we talked to 6 organizations. We interview those organizations, collect as much quantifiable data as we can involving their IT costs and processes as well as their business processes and improvements that they generated before and after implementing Windows Azure, and then design that into a TEI model and develop that into a study, which will be or may already be available as a download from Microsoft's Windows Azure website. And what we do is we pull that in the modeling process. It's just to be clear, the study is not for you to read and then replicate, and you'll get exactly those benefits. These are first and foremost a report on a set of customers and their experiences. You certainly have different business needs, do different processes, so your experiences will, of course, be different, and you'll have different numbers of people at the very least that would be leveraging a Windows Azure solution. But that solution could be many different flavors and sizes, and meet a lot of different business needs. So while your individual business value case will be very unique to your organization, hopefully this study and what I'll summarize today will give you some examples and help start you thinking about how Windows Azure might be valuable for your organization, or if you're already using it, how it might be more valuable to expand that. And so to start, we first listened to the customers and tried to understand what their before state was, or how things were going that led them to consider Windows Azure and eventually implement it. For example, in the development and testing areas, it just became very, without Windows Azure, their own system was very convoluted and hard to manage. Patching and updates took a lot of time. And I think most importantly, and one of the key value areas that I'll get into in a moment, is that especially in a development and test environment, but could be any environment or any need, when you finally decide that you need that hardware, you still have to wait 6 to 8 weeks for it to arrive because there's a procurement process, there's an ordering process, they ship it to you, and then there's still setup and everything else you have to do. So being able to, the time from decision to action can be quite slow and quite a long delay. And as we'll talk about in a minute, that virtually is all but eliminated with some of the options of Windows Azure. So with Windows Azure, their expectations and their own results, they're able to scale down a little bit, or they're able to right size their implementation. since with an on-site implementation, you have to basically scale for your peak need. You have to overbuy for all the other times when you don't need all that hardware. And so one customer, for example, said that they would have had to build out a system of 10 or 20 servers when with Windows Azure they could build it with 4 instances. One sort of specific business process that we talked about with another organization was they have a software product that they distribute they used to distribute it electronically. You would basically email them and they would press a CD and then they would send it to you. And whenever there was an update, they'd have to go through that whole process again and shipping CDs. And it was very confusing. It was very time-consuming. Customers weren't very happy with it. And they implemented a Windows Azure solution where they're able to use authentication. So they now have a protected website where they can leave their software available for download. That once you have the subscription, you get your account, you're able to go in and download it as you need it. If you buy a new computer, you're able to go get it. If you upgrade, if they have an upgrade, you're able to just go straight there and download it, and really saved a lot of time on their side, as well as increase, it also increased their sales because of both in terms of customer satisfaction and ease of being able to make the initial subscription transaction. It was a very easy process for new potential customers. With Windows Azure, they're able to, another organization highlighted the fact that they're able to bring in top talent. Being on some of the, I don't know if you'd necessarily say Windows Azure is the bleeding edge or the cutting edge, but it's certainly demonstrates technology maturity, and programmers and developers and IT personnel want to work with some interesting technologies, and Windows Azure is one of those. And then using the Windows Azure Service Bus, which I'll also get into in a moment in a little bit more detail, one organization was able to really use the service bus to transfer their data from system to system and be able to, in this case, activate coupons in a much more automated and managed way. And so they were spending a lot less time putting together the process, but also there were much fewer instances of coupon errors. And basically it was sort of even though it was an electronic coupon, it was basically paper because it was not connected to anything. It was as if it was paper. So coupons might be used early, late, in the wrong places, using the wrong codes, but they're all being honored because they, customer service, of course, is highly important. With a connected system using Windows Azure Service Bus, they're able to track all that information, understand where there might be some some bottlenecks, some issues, and also be able to measure the results of their coupon campaigns. So here is the top level financials. And I'm sorry this isn't showing up anything. There we go. Sorry. Maybe I just went too fast. There we go. So in those, as I said, we interviewed six organizations, collected information about the size of their implementation, what they were doing with Windows Azure, what modules they were implementing, and we put that into a what we call a composite model, a composite organization. That composite organization measured out to almost a 350% ROI with a net present value of more than $1 million. And that detail is shown here where, and these are some of the topics. This is kind of small on my screen. Hopefully you can read this okay. I'll just click through these to show them all, and I can run through them very quickly. The line in the middle to the left is basically the zero point. So the gray bars to the left are the costs, and you can see that they're relatively small and not too difficult. And then the blue, light blue and dark blue bars to the right are the benefits. And as I talked about, there were software development benefits. There were marketing benefits, improved revenue bringing in new customers and reducing your churn from your existing customers because of that better replacing that mailed CD process to a very clean online process. And of course, there's one that I haven't covered yet, which is, or covered a little bit, but it's avoided hardware costs. So that organization that I mentioned where they were able to implement four Windows Azure instances when they thought that if they had done it on site, they would have had to have bought 10 to 20 servers. Well, that's all savings. That's all avoided costs that they had planned and would have had to spend to maintain their business. But by choosing Windows Azure, they were able to avoid that significant cost, and that is significant this bar is for the organization that we're looking at here, it's upwards of $400,000 to $500,000. And I know you probably have some questions on that, but if you need to chime in now, I can take any questions, but we'll also have plenty of time at the end to answer any of your questions. And I wanted to quickly go through. So that was the financial results. I also wanted to highlight some of the business results in terms of, again, sort of the same topics, but instead of just, you know, financial terms, there's plenty of other ways to measure value than just financials. That organization with the marketing campaign, and they're able to use Windows Azure Service Bus, saw a 75% improvement in their process time leading up to that coupon campaign. I mentioned that organization. Several of the organizations, both the one that said that they had four instances instead of having to buy 10 or 20. Also, other organizations mentioned the procurement process of decision to action of a 6 to 8 week process. That's all avoided time, and that's basically a benefit that can be measured in terms of faster time to market. If you're building a product and you can get that, you can get started 8 weeks sooner, whether that product's internal or customer, revenue generating external. That's benefits that can be measured and captured. And again, I'm just kind of going through the highlights of the study here. You can download and read a lot more detail about that when you look at the study itself. Again, I mentioned the organization that avoided having to buy 20 servers. That also means you're not buying as much of the software that goes on those servers, having to upgrade those or having to upgrade either those in the future or upgrade some current servers you might have now in terms of, you know, bringing them up to spec on networking or processing or any of those kinds of things. You can basically avoid that. And at that time when, you know, say it's the holiday time when and you're a retail store and it's your busy time of the year, you can just go to your Azure dashboard and move the slider, and suddenly you've got increased capacity. As James had said, you know, you pay for what you use, so you'd be paying a little bit more for that time, but you're only paying for what you use when you use it and when you need it. So then back in January and February when things slow down again, you just move the slider back. That's just impossible to do or all but impossible to do with an on-site deployment. And then because of that, as I said, you know, if you needed to scale up, going to the Windows Azure dashboard and just moving a slider, that's certainly a whole lot less time than having to go through the process of identifying what hardware you need, ordering it, waiting for it to arrive, implementing it, plugging it into all the other systems, testing it, making sure everything works. A huge time savings in terms of managing your IT environment, being able to leverage the Windows Azure platform and let Microsoft handle some of those tasks in terms of making sure that patches are updated on time, making sure security is managed appropriately and regularly and so on. Those are just several highlights of some of the organizations that we spoke to. At this point, I'm going to turn it back over to James and let him go into some more of the details of how you might consider this in more detail for your organization.
Thanks so much, Sean. One of the things you'll probably notice as you think about the people that were in that case study that Sean talked about, more often than not, the people that consume cloud services are not central IT. They're usually coming out of the business side, they're coming out of the app dev team, and they're people who are trying to get new engaging applications in front of their customers and in front of their partners as rapidly as possible, which is why so many of the economic elements of Azure are appealing to them. These are not people who care about patching systems. These are not people who care about the processes involved in procuring and deploying new resources. They frankly care less. Those are problems they don't want to deal with. They want to get to market now. And that's a big reason why so many IT operations teams are seeing these development groups bypass them. The key thing to understand is that they're not bypassing you because they don't like you. They're not bypassing you because you're not adding value. They're bypassing you because they need the agility, and that's what these public cloud platforms provide to them. The faster you can get on board with that need, the more effective you will be in helping them go forward, and the less shadow this engagement will become. The more they will want to engage with you because you understand the use of the platform. Now, as I talked about in the beginning, and as you saw in the evidence that Sean presented here, the cloud economics is something you have to understand is different than traditional hosting or traditional data center economics. The sooner you can understand that and the sooner you can make it ingrained in how you think and how you understand the platform, the greater advantage you're going to get from that. And as a result, you can't just immediately get it. You have to experience it. And as you experience it, you'll move up from one stage of understanding of the economics to another and to another. And so we articulate three stages of cloud economics that you will mature through over time. The first one is mostly what Sean's talked about at this point, which is understanding how cloud platforms give you the scale-up elasticity that you can't get in your own data center. Yes, you can have 16 servers in a rack waiting for traffic, and you can scale up in minutes. That's not the value proposition here. The value proposition here is not paying for those 16 systems until you absolutely need them, and then not paying for them when you don't after you've used them for the first time. That's a really key difference that you have to understand, that it truly differentiates public cloud platforms. You can't match that with a private cloud. You can't match that with hosting. You can't match that with things that call themselves cloud and really are not. So it's critically important that you understand this element, because this is not something you're going to build yourself and match. It's something you should add to your overall portfolio. You want to have the Azure option, the public cloud platform option in your portfolio that allows you, when you have the right applications, to take advantage of this capability. Once you truly understand that, have it folded into your portfolio, understand how it's different, understand how you operate it, understand what you don't operate anymore and therefore what operational freedoms and efficiencies you gained, you're able to start thinking about how I can leverage this more. What oftentimes happens with companies is that as they're going through this learning process, they tend to have a catalyst for change that moves them up into the second stage. That catalyst for change, more often than not, is what we oftentimes hear from our customers as the shock bill. And the shock bill is pretty straightforward. Your bill that your business units or that your individual developers might be getting for Azure might be in the $75 to $150, maybe even $300 a month for the use of the service. That's pretty cheap. They can usually put that onto the travel and expense budget. Pretty straightforward to handle. Where they get the shock bill is when that bill goes from $300 a month to $3,000 a month. That's where they're getting greater use of the cloud platform. They're putting more applications out there. They're fully taking advantage of it. But now it's actually a cost that they've got to start to manage. And that's what moves them into the second stage. And the second stage is where you shift your focus from understanding and leveraging cloud economics to trying to optimize your use of the cloud so that you can get those bills down to a more manageable sense, but also so that you can start to optimize your application so that it gets the greatest value out of the cloud. This is a much harder learning cycle, but the companies who are furthest along in doing this are seeing tremendous financial benefits, and I'm going to show you one of these companies in a minute. Really focusing on understanding how to optimize your application's design, optimizing its use of resources, how it scales, what scales, in what way it leverages the services in the cloud, monitoring the performance of the application so you can turn resources off at exactly the right time, really will help you avoid the shock bill and understand that if we're now actually consuming $3,000 a month, that that's actually $3,000 of value with very little waste. When you can get to that point, you're really making a lot of gains from the use of cloud platforms. What will happen after that is to try to take the optimization and analysis of the consumption of cloud resources by application and tie them back not to a cost center, but tie them back to a profit center. When you can get to that point, now you're really taking advantage of the cloud. This is where you understand that a lot of the applications that you're putting in the cloud are actually customer-facing. They may not directly be taking credit cards from people, but they are part of your product, part of your service, part of the value you deliver directly out to customers. At that point, anything that touches your customer, that takes money, that ensures loyalty, that delivers the service value, can be tied back to the profitability of your company. And when you can start identifying revenue streams that are associated with the use of the cloud, now you can really start to optimize, and that's the key. So how do you actually do that? How do you move into an understanding of stage one and then start to move up to stage two, start moving up to stage three? The way you do that is by understanding what are the tools of cloud economics that you have at your exposure. And these are them. There's essentially five of them. There's probably a whole lot more, but if you get these five, you'll achieve some of these gains. Number one, we've talked about quite a bit, time. When do you leverage something? For how long do you leverage it? When do you turn it off? That one's pretty straightforward. Componentization is the second. Instead of having all of your code be in one very large executable that needs an extremely large virtual machine, break that application into reusable components that can scale independently, that can act independently, can be launched independently, and aren't part of your base footprint that's just sitting there waiting for traffic. Third, service choice. What things do you need to build yourself versus what capabilities and services are already present in the cloud platform that you can simply leverage? where you don't have to write code, where you don't have to understand how they interact with each other, where RESTful APIs already present that your developers can tap into. That's the third major tool that you want to pay attention to. Fourth, I talked about earlier, which is caching. You don't need to have very large instances if you can cache the content that we move from one instance to another. You also don't have to have so much elastic scaling on a resource if you can have caching pick up a lot of the traffic that would have hit that instance. Try to cache anywhere and everywhere you can. And again, look at the services. A lot of caching capabilities, the caching services, including cache middleware, end CDNs, are already present in the Azure architecture. You can use those services without having to rewrite them or manage them yourself. And then finally, code optimization. This is the hardest of all the tools, but it's the one that gets the most bang for the buck, where you really analyze how your code behaves, identify what the application behavior is, and can that be changed, optimized, tuned to let you leverage more of the cloud in a more efficient manner. So let's put this into real terms, a real company that is leveraging these tools to achieve their aims. It's a company that's been on Azure for several years. It's called InvoicePay. It is a SaaS application vendor that handles accounts payable for small businesses. Primarily, small businesses tend to move checks or cash between each other. They tend not to use electronic transfer, and so InvoicePay helps them by leveraging invoice transfer back and forth, but give them the sort of easy cash flow that they're quite used to. The way that they do this is by providing a fully cloud-based service that does the transactional handling, works kind of as a bank intermediary between all of the different providers in the small business community in the B2B fashion. For them to be effective, they have to be able to deliver this at a very low cost. Small businesses don't want to pay for big commissions. They're not going to sign up for some big subscription service. And so the way that they've done it is they charge a 40 cents per payment fee, and their profitability is a very small portion of that 40 cents. The way they make their money is by getting more and more transactions to flow through the system. And the more transactions, the more they can offer volume discounts, which encourages more people to use the service. The way they designed this is to ensure that they have an extremely small base footprint when no transactions are taking place, that they have a highly scalable, highly componentized architecture that will only light up when transactions are flowing through. And as soon as a transaction flow declines, they turn it off. They need to make sure that this is extremely highly available, and so they recognize fairly early on that to get to market fast and to ensure that they get high availability, they can't be on the hook for operationally monitoring and managing the availability of everything they do. So they went to a cloud platform and they leveraged the cloud services that were there, such as AppFabric, such as the storage service, such as the security services, such as the caching services, that they could simply tap into knowing that Microsoft would hold the SLA and would ensure the availability of the service. Then all they would have to do is pay attention to how it scales, what degree of redundancy is required to achieve their specific SLA, and as you can see at the bottom of this slide, they wanted a 100% sort of dial tone payment process, and that required them to have multiple instances available in case of any SLA drops. So by simply paying attention to those application-level characteristics and not having to worry about the operational side of things, the infrastructure part of it, they've been able to achieve their objectives. Now, if we look at how they do this, they really pay attention to these key levers that I talked about. I mentioned that they concentrate on time. As soon as transactions are flowing, they fire things up. As soon as they're not, they pull them back. The whole architecture is fully componentized. There's not one big executable here. There's lots of little executables that do this. They're leveraging the App Fabric. They're leveraging other services and capabilities inside of Azure. They're leveraging Azure caching capabilities and services. And where they're spending most of their time is concentrating on the code flow whenever they do payment processing so they can tune and optimize that every single time. Why is this so critical? Because they've gone through stage one and stage two, and they understand that their application running in the cloud is a profit center. Now, understanding that it's a profit center, you have to first look at what is your profit opportunity. If you're getting paid 40 cents per transaction, your profit is not 40 cents. It's 40 cents minus the operational costs associated with achieving that objective. That leaves only pennies. And the way for you to maximize the pennies that go to the bottom line, become the profit for the company, is to reduce that operational cost as much as possible. That's why they concentrate so much on lowering the cost of each and every payment that goes to the system. How they do this? I talked about scaling only when necessary. So if there are no transactions flowing through the invoice pay system, the amount of resources in Azure they're consuming is extremely small. There's no point in lighting anything up until they know they're going to get paid to light that system up. And that's a key lesson for any enterprise, any size organization to pay attention to. They also know that if you have to close a transaction by touching five or six different systems to do it, that means you have to light up five or six different systems, and they're all going to consume resources for some fixed amount of time. So you don't want that happening. That's where caching is so critical. If we have a very chatty application, the more you can fulfill that conversation through cache, and the better off you're going to be. They also pay very strong attention to the services that were out there and could they deliver as good or better performance and as good or better function for what they were trying to achieve so they didn't have to build it themselves. Whatever they don't have to build, they don't have to manage, they don't have to maintain, they don't have to update. It just automatically gets updated, automatically maintained, automatically cached, very much as Sean is talking about in our TEI analysis. So what you want to do is get to the point where you're leveraging and understanding public cloud is different. It provides a different economic model, it provides a different level of agility, and it achieves an opportunity for us to achieve greater profitability with the applications we put there. Does this mean that all applications should go here? No. Does it mean only systems of engagement, only applications that touch customers and are directly tied back to profit should be here? No, because there's economic advantage for some batch applications, for your test and dev cycle, for a variety of other opportunities that you may want to put into the cloud. So it's really important that you understand what kind of applications in my portfolio can take advantage of cloud economics. That may be where I want to go first with that class of applications. So first and foremost, understand what does the profitability profile for your company look like. When you put cloud services there, measure them against that model. Constantly be analyzing the performance of the application so that you can optimize its use of cloud. Constantly also be looking at the new services that are being provided through the cloud platform themselves. These may be native services that come from Microsoft. They may be third-party services that are hosted on Azure that you can also leverage. Anything that's being provided to you that you don't have to build and therefore you don't have to manage and maintain could deliver you greater efficiencies. And then start to bake all of these lessons you learn into an overall architecture and overall operational model so you don't make the same mistake with the second app, with the third app, with the fourth app. It's going to take a long time for you to get marketing, for you to get the business team, for you to get the product teams to stop circumventing IT and going here. If they recognize that the next time they launch an app, they involve central IT in doing it, that they're going to gain all of these advantages by doing that, they will stop going around you. As soon as they see that central IT is value add and understands the cloud and is not going to try and push them away from using a cloud platform but actually understands its value, then you'll have a very positive relationship with them. So really concentrate on understanding these lessons, baking them in, building an area of expertise, having an architectural approach to the cloud, and then maximizing the efficiency from there. So with that, we're going to leave the remaining time we've got here open for Q&A. We've got about 15 or 17 minutes or so. Microsoft, back over to you guys.
Great. Thanks, James. Thanks, Sean. And now for our first question that is coming via Q&A. As a consulting company, how can I leverage this with my customers?
That's a great question. As a consulting company, you're a lot like an invoice pay. Your customers are going to be the ones whose applications go onto the cloud, and you're going to get paid for putting them there, and you're going to get paid and you're going to become more loyal to them the more you can show them how to leverage this efficiently. So much as I talked about how IT needs to get baked in, lessons learned, and understand architecturally how to best take advantage of the cloud, that's your role. So the more you can become not just somebody who can put them in Azure, but someone who can optimize them in Azure, that can keep their Azure bill efficient, help them get the next application up faster and more efficient, and have the third application be optimized from the beginning, you're way more valuable than your competitive consultants that are out there.
Great. James or Sean, do you guys have any guidance on how we can use economic benefits to justify the use of cloud within a large enterprise? And how do we get our finance team to care enough to become advocates for the cloud?
Sean, you want to go first?
Yeah, I can start with that. I think the I think, and hopefully I can get a bit more detailed than this, but I think the easy answer is if you can show them the value, then they're going to be interested, since that's their job to be interested in saving the company money. So, James went through some a detailed customer example. I went through a few, probably at a bit of a higher level. But when I talk through areas like, you know, being able to get hardware up and running, or not hardware, get resources up and running more quickly, which could lead to faster time to market, be able to reduce costs in marketing campaigns, be able to either reduce some software development costs in terms of dev and test, or be able to develop a system that increases customer satisfaction and ease of purchasing, which should, you know, increase revenue. All those kinds of benefits are examples of, you know, maybe some of those fit into your organization, or you can think of someone, you know, those hopefully sort of drive some ideas of your own at your organization to be able to put together a doesn't even have to be all that detailed. You can just start with a back of the napkin kind of thinking around, well, you know, I've got this process and it's taking us this much time, and I know that there's some bottlenecks here and here, and I what I've learned about from Windows Azure and the cloud and cloud economics today, I can save some things here and here. So you can start to think about, you know, whether that's a large enough number to go into some further discussion and further research, and then bring in your finance people when you're ready.
Yeah, and I would add to that your finance team is going to care about financial numbers that are significant. So they're not going to be all that interested in things that are going to save you $500. They're going to be interested in things that are going to save your company $50,000. And that's where you're going to want to take hard numbers from what you've done so far and extrapolate them forward. So if you say our company has 30% of all applications are systems of engagement, and we have done 3 applications in the cloud so far, and here's the economic difference for how we ran them before in-house and how we ran them now in the cloud, which is exactly what we did in this TEI analysis. So feel free to use these numbers as a starting point as an example. If you can then extrapolate that to the rest of the applications that are there, you'll quickly get to the number he's going to be interested in. And so that's the right way to approach this. The other nice thing about cloud platforms is you don't have to guess as to what the cost will be in the cloud. You can use the cloud for a week, and you'll get back a detailed bill of actual consumption, real numbers. So none of this sort of guesswork that you typically see. You know, should we upgrade to the next version of Oracle? Well, Oracle says we'll save 30%. Who knows if that's going to be true? This is real hard numbers. So get in there, get an account, use your credit card, start using Azure, and you'll get real numbers.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, guys. Another question comes in sort of related. What's your messaging to conservative CIOs that raise cases like Target's recent security breach?
Yeah, so there's a really important thing to think about when it comes to security. You probably don't have enough people on your staff to be as secure as a very large enterprise does. And no matter how good you think you are, the hackers are better. So your best defense is actually to get as much help in managing security as you can. And by using a cloud platform, that is one thing you're achieving. So who's now on your security team? The Azure security team is now part of your security team. Now, anytime you go into the cloud, you have to understand that the security is what we call an uneven handshake. There's a portion of the platform that is managed and secured by the vendor. Then there's what you do on that platform, and that's actually your responsibility. So you could easily put an application on Azure, which has really good security, really good monitoring, really good perimeter security observation constantly going on. But if you put an application on there and you open port 80 and you make that instance live and available to anybody, you're the one who broke the security. It's not Microsoft's fault. It's not any other cloud provider's fault. It's your fault. So understanding that is how you go into using the cloud. And you're more likely to be more secure on a platform where you've got a bigger team who can help support and ensure your security than you are by yourself. Another thing to do beyond that is if you're not sure how to handle your half of the uneven handshake in the cloud, work with a consultant who does. Bring in someone who can do managed services, who can do security-specific services on top of the cloud, who has that expertise, and that's an even better way to do it. You still have the risk of being a target? Sure you do. Every single company has a potential risk of being a target. But you just have to do all that you possibly can to protect yourself from that, and you have to be able to have plans in place for what you're going to do if it happens.
And this is Sean. As I understand the Target security breach, it was in part, you know, malware being installed, which often is part of user error or clicking on something you're not supposed to, or security profiles that aren't updated, and part of Microsoft's offering and its SLA is that those kinds of settings, security settings, security profiles. All remain up to date so that, even if, as James said, it is an uneven handshake, even if a user does, you are still at the mercy of employees or along with hackers and others, but, even employees that that click on something they're not supposed to, Windows Azure is going to be, more likely than other systems to be up to date.
Great. Thanks. As we continue to go through Q&A, I'm going to pull up a quick survey for the audience. The survey is going to have two questions on it. On a scale of 1 to 4, how useful did you find this webinar? And then what other topics would you like to see us cover in the future? If the audience, you guys could go ahead and answer those questions while we continue on. So the next question for James and Sean, are there common pitfalls or misconceptions you've seen firms encounter when evaluating cloud investments?
So one of the biggest mistakes we see a lot of companies do is just on that, is it the straightforward assumption that I mentioned before, that putting something in the cloud is just like what I have in my data center. So I take a really ugly, crappy application that's got complex code and all sorts of interdependencies and really, really big instances, and I'll just migrate it over the cloud and it'll instantly be cheaper. I can guarantee you it'll instantly be more expensive. It'll be more expensive because you require all of these resources. The app will be on 24/7, and the app will still be a crappy code. It'll just be crappy code on a better platform. So that's probably the biggest mistake we see. You really do need to understand how these platforms differ and put the right applications on them. Now, it doesn't mean that crappy application can't eventually be brought over to the cloud, but it will need to be re-architected to deliver the greatest advantage. So that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that we see. The second is to not understand the uneven handshake, to just assume that now that it's on a cloud platform, that Microsoft's going to take care of everything. So what do you mean it was my fault I left port 80 open? What do you mean it's my fault that I didn't have snapshots available of my data? You still have to understand where their service stops and therefore where you take over from there. The third mistake that we oftentimes see is if I put it in the cloud, it's suddenly everywhere. No. If you put it in the cloud, it is in whatever data center you chose to put it in, and that's it. It doesn't automatically go to Sydney, Australia. It doesn't automatically go to China. It doesn't automatically get replicated into Europe. You have to put those things there yourself. And there's some good security reasons why it's not automatically put in those other locations. So that's another thing to pay attention to. So those are a few examples of the types of typical mistakes that we see in the approach.
Great. Another question, what metrics should we be using to measure economic impact? ROI, TCO, or something else?
I think it'll depend on your organization and what your finance team and what your upper management executives care about the most. If you know that your organization is only focused on costs and cost savings, then you'll want to focus on TCO and only highlight those hard cost benefits. In the TEI study, for example, that would be around that may just be the avoided hardware cost cost avoidance benefit. maybe a little bit from and the reduced IT management and software development costs. So that may be as far as you as they would find useful in that TEI study. I think the examples in the TEI study around the marketing and sales benefits, those are, you know, good examples, but they are really just examples. There's no exact list of benefits that you should or shouldn't include in your analysis for your organization. It's going to be what's important to you and your executives and your managers. If you're a retail organization, then certainly sales. But if you are a product development organization, then you're going to want to dig into supply chain and operations metrics and identify, what financials you can both the KPI, the key performance indicator metrics, but also how you can translate those into financials, whether revenue generating or cost savings. Certainly, in a Windows Azure analysis or a cloud economics analysis, avoiding hardware costs, reducing IT management time, those are probably givens and would be included in most every analysis. On the cost side, there's actually a question here that I'll just cover very quickly. On the cost side, the costs include the license cost of Windows Azure, the little bit of time, or at least I shouldn't say little bit, less than was covered before or was included before, but the management time to administer the Azure system, and then there's some ramp up implementation costs that are included in the analysis. So those costs you'd want to include as well on the cost side. Including, and then have those cost savings benefits, and then any business benefits or process specific benefits that are, that are tailored for your organization.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add on that as well is that one mistake we see often is misrepresenting your current costs. A lot of times companies come in and they say, well, here's my comparison. In-house, it costs us the Oracle license, the Microsoft license, and three people. No, it also counts your servers, your server maintenance, your data center costs, your facility costs. There's a bunch of other costs that you may have left out.
Yep.
Great. We've got time for about one more question. The last question is, what type of projects do customers often start with on Azure or the cloud in general?
In general, almost always they start with test and dev of new systems of engagement. These may be mobile applications, new websites, intranet applications, survey services, batch applications are also common here. Oftentimes things that are not sort of business critical, but are important and have an agile aspect to them. That's the best way to really learn about the platform, understand how it works. And once you're done with the test and dev cycle, you can do a one-click live, and it is now a production application on the Azure environment. Those are the fastest ways to learn and understand the platform and to really move forward from there. And in more cases than not, these are all applications that scale elastically and scale horizontally.
Yep. And in the TEI study, there certainly were a number of dev and test implementations. There were also a couple that were backup and storage using the StorSimple solution that's sort of an add-on to the Windows Azure resources. And I didn't cover
All right.
that.
Well,
hardly at all in this discussion today, but you'll find more details about that in the document. Sorry, Charles, I stepped on your
No, that's okay. No worries. Well, I'd like to give a special thanks to you, James, and Sean for your presentations today. And thanks to the audience. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Great day.